studios of Boise State Public Radio. I'm Gemma Gaudette. A new novel called The Hunter puts to rest some tropes about suspense novels, things like a dead woman and a good or a bad cop. The book's author, Jennifer Herrera, is joining us today to talk more about this. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, so we should note, this is actually your debut novel, so congrats on that.
Thank you.
What was it like to write a book? Because I think a lot of people always, you know, have dreams of doing that, and mm-hmm. you know, and you think about it for years, and it never happens.
Yeah, and so I think that is an accurate depiction of most people trying to write a book, and it certainly was for me for many years. I have the luxury of working in publishing, so I am a literary agent at the David Black Agency in New York City. And so I've seen firsthand what it takes to write a book, and it's really hard, and it takes a lot of passes. And I think it took me many, many years to feel like I had the, you know, the stamina to be able to do it. And the thing that finally got me to sit down and do it was honestly the pandemic. So I had a lot of anxiety. I needed a lot of places for that anxiety to go. And I had a lot of time that I didn't have before. And suddenly it became an obsession in the way that, you know, we can often become obsessed with things and we don't want to look out our window. And so I guess one positive thing came out of the pandemic.
You know, I'm wondering too, if you're getting a lot of manuscripts coming into your agency now, right? Because everybody took that time during the pandemic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for editors especially, so editors are the ones, the publishing houses who buy the book for people who don't know. And editors have been so burnt out the past few years because so many people were home and were able to work that they just got, you know, a deluge of submissions, so that a lot of really great editors left the business because they couldn't, you know, they just burnt out. They couldn't sort of deal with, you know, the opening of the floodgates.
Holy cow, that is so interesting. Okay, so let's talk about this book, because as I mentioned, some of the things that really stuck out to me, I mean, honestly, when I first picked up the book, and it is about a female detective, but also it's male homicide victims. Mm-hmm. And I literally almost, I did a double take. I was like, what? Wait a minute. We're talking about men who are homicide victims. So I know that might sound silly as a reaction, but I think the majority of books, you know, a thriller, suspense novels, it's always a woman who is the victim. So why was it important to you to change that up?
Well, first off, I'm glad you had that reaction, because I feel like that's where, you know, most people realize like, oh, wow, I've been following a cultural script that I didn't even realize, right? Yeah. Having that moment of having expectations thwarted when you didn't even know that was the expectation. You know, so for me, when I sat down to write a book, I had to immediately decide like who would die. And the first person I thought of was like a young woman, a young, beautiful woman, in fact.
Of course.
This was, yeah, exactly, as one does. And this was really disturbing to me because I really love women. Like, you know, most of my close friends are women. And so why did I immediately think, you know, a woman should die? And so I started to do some research on the subject. I looked at, first off, the rate of homicides, like at what percentage is male versus what percentage is female. And it turns out that 80% of homicides in this country are male. So the victims are male. And then I did an informal study of just, you know, the top 50 or so best-selling books on Amazon in this genre. And I read synopses. I read, you know, some first pages. And it looked like women were killed at a 3-to-1 ratio of men. So women were 3 times more likely to die in books than men. And this I thought was really interesting because, first off, we have this genre that prides itself on verisimilitude, right? You're getting all of these authors who are saying, oh, you know, I did this ride along with a detective for 3 years, and that's how I got the details right in my books. And yet they're skewing really far from the facts when it comes to this one important detail. So I have lots of theories as to why this could be the case, but I knew that in writing my own book, I wanted it to be a corrective of that. Mm. And so I wanted to have a female detective be the one with the power, the one with the insight, the one who, you know, whose mind we're following, and have the victims in this case be men.
You know, I think this is so interesting too, in particular when you go back to that statistic, right? Of 80% of homicide victims are men in this country. That sounds surprising, but then if you take a step back, it's like, yeah, that actually makes sense. Mm-hmm. With that said, though, I think even within the media, the majority of the homicides that get a lot of attention, right, whether that's mm-hmm. local or national, tend to be, you know, pretty white women.
Yes.
And so not only, I think, do we see this in books, we see it within our culture. And mm-hmm. I mean, so for you, was that part of it too? Was like, well, wait a minute, this actually isn't reality, but mm-hmm. we've kind of skewed it into our reality.
Yes. And I think that, you know, a couple of things happen when we pay so much attention to the pretty white woman who dies versus everyone else. First off, mm-hmm. we're saying that her life is more important than everybody else's life, which I don't think is true, right? I think people's lives are valuable equally. But I think the other thing that happens when we kill off so many women is that it sends women a message that you are not safe. And when we, 100%. You know, when we're paying attention to the news cycle, when we're focusing on the deaths of these women, we're again saying you are not safe, even though that's differing, you know, different from the facts. And so I was hoping that with this book, you know, readers could not get that message for once in our lives, to feel like, oh no, you can be the shot caller.
Mm. And I think too, you know, not only do you switch that narrative, right? I think you tackle some other really big issues in this book. One being police corruption. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that goes hand in hand, frankly. I mean, you think about, you know, you wrote this book during the pandemic. I mean, that's also when, you know, everyone's sitting at home and we can't mm-hmm. turn away from what happened to George Floyd, right?
Yes.
There is kind of a reckoning that seemed to happen mm-hmm. During the pandemic. Did that play into this at all for you when you decided to also tackle that subject?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this is something that is going to mark a change in crime fiction generally over the coming, hopefully at least decade, and hopefully longer than that, where we will be less concerned about, you know, a detective who's colorblind, or a detective who doesn't have to deal with the ugly parts about being a detective. But those who actually do have to, like, try to do a really good job. Like, I think the police play a very important role in, you know, in the structuring of our society. I think detectives, homicide detectives, play a very important role. And the question is, how can they do their jobs, even when they try really hard to make all of the right choices? You know, how are they thwarted from exercising justice? Mm-hmm. And second off, you know, from feeling as though they're on the side of the good guys.
Why also was it important to you to also address these other issues, which, you know, you look at mental illness in the book,
you write
about that, racial stereotypes. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are big, hefty, heavy issues.
Yeah.
And you put all of them together in this book. And what I appreciated about it was I didn't feel like I was being lectured. I didn't feel like it felt part of the story and the narrative of the story.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, my experience is always going to be informed by, you know, how I've existed in the world. Right. And when I was a kid, I grew up in a trailer park, which, you know, even though it wasn't economically diverse, it was diverse in every other way. And then when I was about 5, we moved to a small town in rural Ohio that was extremely white. you know, everybody was the cousin of somebody else. They all went to the same church. It was so alienating for me. And it felt so separate from the reality that I'd always known. And so, you know, growing up, I felt like there was something wrong with this. Like I was like, where are all the rest of the people? You know, where are the people who don't have the same mental health status? Where are the people, you know, who aren't straight? Where are the people of color and the Black people? And so I wanted to write a book that, you know, that felt real to me. And I hadn't set out to write an issues book. I don't think that, you know, I would be the right person to write that book. But I did want to write a book that represents reality as I know it. And reality is diverse and it's messy and it's beautiful. And I hope that I captured all of those elements.
I really think that you did, and you did it in such a way that, as I said, didn't feel like you were trying to educate or preach. And it really, you know, a lot of it, I think, comes down to the main character of the book, Leah, and really what she has gone through, not just professionally, but personally, when she goes back to her hometown. Because I think, you know, so many of us leave our hometowns, right? Especially when we grow up in these small rural towns, like I did, like you did. And when you come back, it's almost like it puts you back in this place that you wanted so desperately to leave, but it will always be forever connected to you.
Yes.
And did you feel that? Yeah. Did you feel that writing the book?
Oh, absolutely. So I don't live in my hometown anymore. My hometown has about 1,300 people. It's in Northwest Ohio. And I've lived all over the country. I've lived in Missouri and California and New York City and Philadelphia, where I live now. And so I'm profoundly aware of the ways in which, like, my hometown is different from lots of other places. And I don't want to move back there. But at the same time, I can't help but miss certain elements of that place. I can't help but think who I might have been had I stayed. You know, if I would be closer to my family, or if, you know, we would have Sunday dinners. Like, for some reason, Sunday dinners always sound very appealing to me, even though I'm sure I would, you know, end up being the one cooking and cleaning.
Right, exactly. Then they drive you crazy. You know, yeah.
You have this unlived life that you have to reckon with. And I think one of the joys about being a writer is that you're able to reckon with that unlived life. And I think, you know, what if Lee went back to her hometown and dealt with all of the emotional baggage that maybe she hasn't, you know, dealt with for many, many years? And how would her life change if she were able to combine those places? She didn't have to feel like she had to choose between her hometown and the rest of the world, but she could feel at peace in both places.
You know, it's interesting to me, too, when you talk about the fact that you've lived in numerous places across the country. So have I. And I grew up in a small town as well, very blue collar. And it's interesting to me when you meet people who maybe live in these big urban areas, and it's really the only place they've ever lived.
Because it's weird.
It's weird because there is an idea that they are more sophisticated, that they are more informed. And I tend to think that I feel very lucky that I have lived in every part of this country. I have lived in small towns, in big cities, racially diverse, not racially diverse. And I think it informs your perspective of human nature in a way that it doesn't when you stay somewhere, right?
That's so beautiful. Yes. I honestly never thought about it that way. But especially when I was living in New York City, you know, I was very aware of being a small town girl in the big city. And I think I felt a lot of anxiety about that because I felt, oh, these people, you know the names of all of these private schools. They know New York City in a way that I will never, ever know New York City. And I felt anxious because I felt like I lacked sophistication because I had lived in other places. But I think you're right. I think there is something that's special that allows you, that you can tap into if you are a person who's lived in lots of places. You have a greater empathy, I think. You know, when I was in New York, a lot of people would talk about flyover country. And I remember getting so upset Because to them, it was just this big monolith, like everything between California and New York was this huge monolith that was all the same. And I thought, wow, how like unlucky for them that they'll never get to know like that vast tapestry that exists.
Well, and also it gives you a perspective of, I think, why there is division in our country. Mm-hmm. And why people believe certain ways, right?
Yes.
It's because you've lived in those areas.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think it's so easy if you haven't to be judgmental about especially political differences,
right.
Especially views on the police, right? If you've, mm-hmm. if you don't have any family who, you know, are police officers, of course you can keep a very narrow perspective. I think I'm lucky that I have, you know, I have family on a lot of different sides. I have people I love on a lot of different sides. And it's like, you know, the people I care about the same thing, which is we care about human life and figuring out right. how to bridge some of the divides. And some of those are really false, right? What's keeping us all from agreeing at the end of the day. And I think mm-hmm. that if you are a person who's only ever lived a very specific type of life, you know, you can maybe feel more hopeless about the world.
And I think too, when you come from these small towns, a lot of times, as you said, there is this anxiety of like feeling like you're not enough, that you yes. aren't sophisticated enough. Right. And yes. as I've aged, I thought, I always say this to people. I'm like, look, there's a little bit of redneck in everybody and you need to embrace it.
I love that. I'm going to steal that.
I mean, seriously, right. I mean, but you do. You need to embrace that. Yes. Like you need to because that does inform who you are. It does give mm-hmm. you empathy and compassion. And I think sometimes we want to not honor all of those aspects of ourselves, but I know that sounds silly, but I do. I'm always like, you know, there's a little bit of redneck in everybody. You just go with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we're all better off when we learn to honor and be compassionate about those sides of ourselves too. You're right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I have to say this was, I mean, honestly, what a great novel. I think that the issues that you write about are just, they're such a part of our society right now. And I love that it's the main character is a female. She's strong. But man, mm-hmm. you threw me for a loop with the male murder victims. But I kind of like it.
I love that though. I love that. How did you feel reading about that? Did you feel like you lacked compassion for them?
You know, I didn't. And I think that's what's mm-hmm. interesting, right? Is that all of a sudden you see these they are victims, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
and I think it's interesting that I definitely question certain things about them. You know, in the beginning, in the way I don't think I would if it had been a female victim, if that makes sense.
Like, what's an example?
Well, kind of like, how did this, like, the bigger question was, how did this happen to them? Why did uh-huh. they let this happen to them? Uh-huh. Whereas I think with women, it's this, oh my gosh, this poor woman. Oh, uh-huh. you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, where you automatically see the woman as this in this victim state where of course something would happen and this poor thing because she's defenseless. And you yes. think, oh, but these men, they have this testosterone that gives them these muscles. Like, shouldn't right. they have been able to defend themselves?
Right. I mean, I will tell you this. I mean, and I'm sure you've heard of it, this horrifying murder case that's happening here in Idaho right now with these University of Idaho students.
Yes.
You know, when we found out that there was three young women and one male, I think everyone was stunned that there was a male that was a victim, right? Mm. Because it doesn't go along with, I think, our cultural narrative of who murder victims are.
Yep. Yep.
And so you really tackle that in the book as well, that, you know, men can be victims. They are more likely victims of homicide. And we need to make space for that, I think too, right? Is that everyone's yes. human, everyone is vulnerable.
Yes, exactly. And especially, you know, these days, I think back in the day, probably before firearms, right? It was, you know, women were at a disadvantage, but right now it's like, right. you know, anybody can be shot. Anybody can have somebody overpower them in that way. We are all vulnerable. And in fact, you know, if we look at the statistics, men are more vulnerable than women are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It honestly was such a good book. I thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
It really has been. We've been talking with Jennifer Herrera about her debut novel, The Hunter. It is available now. It's a great read. So grab a copy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.